Hello, and thank you for downloading this Conversations podcast. If you don't already subscribe, you can do it completely free of charge. It's easy. Details are on our website, abc.net.au/conversations, or just look for Conversations with Richard Feidler through iTunes.
While Richard Feidler is away, you're hearing some favourite conversations of the past few years. Richard will be back in January.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello, good morning. My guest for you today is one of the world's best-selling authors, Lee Child. But Lee Child wasn't always a writer. He used to work at Granada TV in the UK in a highly skilled job that he expected to be doing for the rest of his life. Then came a major restructuring at Granada and Lee was laid off. But he had a plan. Lee sat down at his dining room table and started to write a book in longhand. That book was called Killing Floor and it introduced a character called Jack Reacher. 13 books later, Jack Reacher is one of the most popular characters in fiction. He's the loner who comes into town with literally no baggage. He has some life experience, an even temperament, a far-sighted intelligence, and an unspoken moral core. And that means he's the guy you need to save the day. Lee Child, welcome to Conversations.
Thank you for asking me. It's great to be here.
Good thriller writers, that said, need to have a mountain of trivia in their head. Have you got all that? Have you got the mountain? Are you good at holding vast amounts of trivia in your head?
Vast amounts, absolutely. I know nothing of any consequence whatsoever, but a lot of trivia.
I'm told that you know why watches in ads are always set at 8 minutes past 10. Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. It was a great story explained to me by an advertising person. And I had thought, you know, the hands are set to that time so that the maker's name is shown. But actually, plenty of times could give you that opportunity to see the maker's name. It used to be 10 minutes past 10. And the reason for that is that then the watch looks like it's smiling at you. And it produces a warm sensation in the person who's looking at the advertisement, a warm, receptive feeling. And then they moved it very subtly. This is the bit I like best. They moved it to 8 minutes past 10 because we were so used to seeing it at 10 minutes past 10 that the 8 minutes past 10, it almost looked like a moving picture. We were just waiting for that hand to move. And it gave the picture a dynamic quality.
What do you make of that? That struck you as silly? As a man who watched enormous amounts of television in his professional life?
Yeah, I love stuff like that. I love to understand how things work and why decisions are made. You know, doing these interviews when the books come out, I would much rather talk to you about your job, you know, the ins and outs, the tricks of the trade, the pitfalls, the little things you do. I'm much more interested in stuff like that than talking about myself.
Of course, I suppose the art of writing a thriller is what you hide rather than what you reveal. When you're trying to interview someone, you actually need to ask a question that ideally will nail down certain things and be easily understood. But I suppose when you're asking that question in a thriller, the question itself has to have questions in it too.
Yeah, and there can be a string of questions. There are short-term questions that you don't answer for a line or two or a page or two or a chapter or two. And then there's the overall question that the whole book has to answer eventually by the end.
You say that the thriller is the original story, the original book. Why do you say that?
Well, because I'm very interested in anthropology and prehistory and the invention of language. And we don't know when it happened, obviously, because as soon as the first word was spoken, the echo dies away and it's lost forever. It's not an artifact. It's not written down. It was oral. And so language is invented. We don't know when. It was maybe, I don't know, 200,000 years ago, 150,000 years ago. But language was all about telling the truth. It was essential to tell the truth, to coordinate and cooperate, because those early humans actually were pretty weak. They were weak, spindly, slender little animals that were not doing very well. And yet suddenly, with language, they could coordinate 20, 30, 40 humans in a group, and suddenly that group was the most powerful animal on Earth. So language was essential for survival, but it was about telling the truth. You said, watch out, there's a saber-toothed tiger behind that bush, and you had to mean it, because it was meaningless if you didn't mean it. And then somewhere along the line, and again, we don't know where, but somewhere along the line, people started talking about things that hadn't happened to people that don't exist. In other words, fiction was invented. And we can assume it was a way long time ago. And anything that happened a long time ago, you know, 80,000, 100,000 years ago, anything that happened was all about survival. It had to have a purpose. There was no such thing as leisure time. There was no such thing as hobbies. It was all essential. So how could storytelling help us survive? How could a story make it more likely that we would all wake up the next morning better off than we'd been the day before in terms of survival? And my guess is that those early stories must have been about peril survived or danger survived. Maybe the first story was about some caveman who was chased by a saber-toothed tiger but managed to escape and make it back to the cave. In other words, then the people listening to that story would feel a little bit empowered. They would feel a little braver. They would know that, yes, you can walk to the edge of the cliff, but you don't have to fall off. In other words, it was a survival instinct to help us. And then maybe that story evolved into a man is chased by a saber-toothed tiger and turns around and kills it. And there's the first hero. And so I think thrillers, which are about danger and peril and then resolution and safety at the end of it, I think they must have been the first stories. It's an unbroken chain, probably, going back 100,000 years. And thriller writers like me are still telling that kind of story. Danger and then safety. Disorder and then resolution. I think we're still doing it.
When you created your Jack Reacher character, who's enormously appealing, specifically to women, and particularly to women, I'll talk about that in just a moment, are you reaching back to these kind of legendary antecedents? Because reading your books, Jack Reacher is like Beowulf. The guy, then there's a problem, the place is a mess, there's something frightening at the door, and this guy walks in, and he doesn't blow his own trumpet, he doesn't say much, it's not really even clear where he's from, but he'll handle it.
Yeah, that's exactly what he is. There's an unbroken chain of such figures, invented over and over again. People say to me, oh, Reacher is just like the guys out of the old westerns in America. You know, the guy, mysterious loner, rides into town, sorts out the trouble, and rides off into the sunset. And of course he is like that, but that character was not invented by Americans 100 years ago. As you say, that character comes from much earlier in history. Beowulf, maybe even earlier than that. There are all kinds of Middle Ages interpretations, Robin Hood, all those kind of things. It's a character that humans seem to need because it's self-evident, I think. If you are in trouble, of course you would like somebody to walk in and fix it and then move on. Absolutely you would.
When you're frightened. Like, as readers, we seem to be like the start of the thing. We're the frightened people in the bus, aren't we, at the start, when the bus has gone off on the ice in the middle of a snowstorm. We want someone. And is it Daddy coming to help us? Who is it? Who is this person that comes to help us?
It's a metaphor, essentially, for I think it's our better natures or what we would be if we could be is what is coming to help us, which is why these characters are rather shadowy. You said very interestingly that he shows up and appears to have no past. Absolutely, because it's just today that we need him. It's not a real, fully-fledged character. It's the help today that we need, which is why also all these myths have him move on again at the end of the story, because it's not about somebody staying in the community. It's that temporary help. That's what we need. And I think it's a metaphor for what we would do if we could. And that's really what these books are as well. I think as readers, we read them and we think, wow, I would like to be like that. If only I was just a little bit tougher, just a little bit braver, we could be like that.
Your books are sold all over the world. I mean, people will, in America, they will want to see Jack Reacher as a specifically American character. But then you're English yourself by origin, and you've pointed to Robin Hood there. In the various countries you're published in, do they look to their own antecedents and go, well, actually, this guy's actually kind of a Japanese character, or this guy's actually a German character, or this is actually quite an Indian archetype we're looking at here?
Absolutely. That's exactly what happens, because these myths are universal. Every culture has them, so they see
them. But
they
think they're special to themselves.
They do. They think it's only happened there. And certainly, yeah, Japan, you know, they say to me, yeah, I know, I understand you're writing for America because that's where the money is, but come on, surely this guy is a ronin, which is that particular Japanese character who is literally a knight errant. A ronin is a warrior disowned by his master and just sent out to wander on his own account. And so the Japanese are convinced that I'm copying Japanese culture. The Germans, that you know, Middle Europe, Middle Ages.
Teutonic Knight. Yes,
yeah, the Black Forest and all that kind of stuff. They think it's that. I've had it said, you know, even in Australia, yeah, come on, this is really Australian, isn't it? Because of that mythical figure roaming the outback in the old days.
Crocodile Dundee, isn't
it? Well, Crocodile Dundee is kind of Reacher's second cousin, as it were. You know, they all spring from the same well.
I did mention this character's appeal to women. My producer is said she's in love with him. I'm just going to embarrass Pam by saying that now. And a whole lot of other people in the office, women in the office, will say that as well. I don't think men fall in love with women on the printed page. What do you think women do?
I think because women feel certain things very passionately. And I think Reacher has two of the things that women really want. One is that he is almost feminine in his own reaction to injustice. Anecdotally, I think women are more offended by injustice than men. I think if you notice every 100 people that you hear say, it's just not fair, 99 of them are women. Women get very offended by injustice, as does Reacher. And Reacher then puts the injustice right. So I think that is a narrative arc that women really like. And, of course, to be honest, Reacher is the ultimate safe affair in the sense of, you know, I'm not suggesting anything about anybody that I know, but people are kind of interested in getting together with other people here and there. But, of course, they don't, because in the real world, it turns out very messy.
You know, consequences.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, you get found out and you have to retire from golf for 6 months or whatever it is.
And apologize to the world.
Apologize to the world, yeah. Lose your house. It's all a mess.
But in the
fantasy sense, suppose you could guarantee that this guy would hang around for like 48 hours and then move on and he would never call. He would never return. In other words, it's ultimately safe. And I think that is a very powerful fantasy for women. And I think some things about Reacher are very powerful fantasies for men, too. The fact that he wanders, as you said, no baggage, which is, again, a metaphor. Physically no baggage, but emotionally no baggage. He has no commitments. He has no attachments. He has no possessions. So men, and I've had it at all kinds of book signings, you know, these guys in expensive suits, they're clearly bankers or lawyers or something like that. They come up to get their book signed and they lean over the table and they kind of whisper, I wish I could do that. Because that is a very powerful fantasy, the idea that you can leave it all behind and just walk off into the sunset. You've got no idea where you're going to be tomorrow.
Lee Child is my guest in conversation today, the author of the Jack Reacher novels. We talked about, you know, what you reveal and what you don't reveal and the questions you ask in order to keep readers engaged in a thriller. There's also a lot you don't show in your books. There's not brutal violence. Or if there is brutal violence, it's implied. You don't really see that up front. There's sex happening, but it's not right up front, and you're not right there in the bedroom taking notes while they're doing it. And there's not even swearing, really, from Jack Reacher. Tell me about that, your thinking behind that.
Well, it was a conscious decision for the books. You know, it's not that I'm a prude. I use all kinds of language myself. You know, my language in private is industrial strength. But when you really understand that, and we all know this, we hear people swearing, that it's an art form, it's a flow, it's this unstoppable river where words are used as nouns, adjectives, adverbs, all in the same sentence. And if you were to transliterate that authentically, the book would be about 8,000 pages long. And so you can't have a book that long, so inevitably you have to edit it, which has the effect of the words that you leave in actually take on more significance than they do. They shouldn't have a special significance if they're just part of a torrent. But if you leave isolated examples in here and there, they take on undue weight. So I thought what I'm going to try and do is do tough guy books without any swearing, because it seemed to me that was a more honest approach. Either it's all or nothing. And I went for the nothing.
That makes you different too, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. And a lot of people appreciate it, actually. I've had literally thousands of letters saying, thank you very much for leaving it out. I've had no letters at all asking me to put it in. And I've had actually lots of comments where people don't believe that it's not in. because the tough guy ambiance and the tough guy spirit comes through, and people assume it's there, even though it's not.
However, you haven't banked on Australians having a perverse sense of humour. You will now, having said this on the wireless, receive letters from Australians asking you to have more swearing in your books. Is the fact that he's a former military policeman got anything to do with the fact that he doesn't swear? Is there code there?
There is, actually, because in the U.S. Army, and, you know, all armies are different and all armies are full of traditions, in the U.S. Army, commissioned officers, generally speaking, do not swear. It's just one of the things. Enlisted men and women, yes, they do. But the officers, no, they don't. And so I felt that it was also consonant with Reach's implied backstory, that he's that... Because, you know, again, let's go back to what he said. He's a knight errant, and the errant part is easy enough. He's a wanderer, but the knight is also important. He's got to have a certain nobility, a certain rank, and so his status as a former officer, adhering to an officer's code, I felt was important.
Let's talk about your background. It's hard to tell now from your accent, but you, as you say, you're from the English Midlands originally. You were born in Coventry?
Yeah, born in Coventry, but left very soon. I guess I was four. We moved to Birmingham, which is now really all part of the same conurbation, but at the time it was a separate city.
When I'm thinking, I'm guessing this is the 50s and 60s you're growing up in, and I get bleak pictures from that. Are they correct?
Yeah, it was, you know, the quote is, the past is another country, and it really was. It was a different time, and in provincial England, London might have been different, but provincial England was very grey, very bleak, very economically depressed, and somewhat... morally depressed. The morale was down, in as much as for us kids, you know. Actually, World War II did not finish in Britain until 1963, when the Beatles hit big. It was World War II. It really was the post-war phase, and it affected us in two ways. First of all, economically, the country was ruined. Physically, the country was ruined. I was born 9 years after the war, and my first memories must be, I don't know, 12, 13 years after the war. And yet still, I can remember countless acres of destruction. And we would play in these ruined buildings as like jungle gyms.
Unexploded bombs in there as well?
They were always being discovered. Unexploded bombs, old rusted guns, grenades, all this kind of stuff. It was a regular occurrence. But even worse than that was that the kind of feeling that history was over, because we had this generation as parents who had been involved in World War II, which was undoubtedly the biggest, most dramatic thing possibly in all of history. And at the time, Churchill said, this is our finest hour. And it was. You know, there's no argument with that. It was an amazing time to have lived through. But we hadn't lived through it, and we were left with the impression that it was all done. All the good stuff was behind. There was nothing ahead. Nothing coming could possibly be as exciting or as dangerous or as perilous or as important as that. And that left a kind of very bleak feeling for the young people around that time.
I'm trying to remember the British writer who was complaining that Britain in that period was exhausted by the war, and all Britain wanted to do was just to sit outside and have a nice, quiet cigarette.
And a cup of tea.
And a cup of tea.
Yeah.
And that's what you grew up in, of course, as a young man, a bit of energy, perhaps suspecting that life was elsewhere.
Yeah, I definitely felt that life was elsewhere, because other countries seemed to have gotten over it better. I mean, other countries were less affected, frankly. America, for instance, had participated, of course, in World War II, but hadn't been physically affected at home in the same way. And there had been millions of GIs in Britain, of course, during World War II, but they had long gone, and there wasn't much left of them other than kind of fragments of this or fragments of that and almost archaeological memories of them. And people had artifacts from America. They had, you know, maybe they had a cousin or an uncle or something who traveled back and forth, and so some kid would have half of a Superman comic and some kid would have half of a Batman comic, and we used to pore over this stuff as if it was the Rosetta Stone, and it seemed to imply this land of fantastic plenty and opportunity and glamour and excitement. Somebody said at the time, we had LucasAid and Morris Minors. they had Coca-Cola and Cadillacs. And it really felt like that.
Tell me about there's a book that made a big impact on you. It was part of the My Home Inn series.
Yeah, and that was typical of the whole thing. You know, our local library where we lived was a Nissen hut, which was, you know, those sort of semicircular metal huts that were left over from World War II. And it had precious few books in it. And one of the books was My Home in America. And it was probably a series. There might have been other books in the series, but our library only had that one. My Home in America, it was one of those cardboard children's books with about 12 pages. And it was a color picture of different representative homes. And for the American one, they had the New England salt box and the prairie farmhouse and the California bungalow. And then I turned the page and there was this picture. The only picture drawn from the inside looking out was this little boy sitting on the window ledge of a Manhattan skyscraper looking out over New York City, all lit up at night. And I thought, wow, I just loved that picture. And I thought I was that boy. I thought, why am I here? How have I got so misplaced? I should be there. I should be. And I was probably 4 or 5 at that time. And that feeling, that absolute certainty that I did not belong in England, that I should be in America, suddenly it just never left me.
That's where you live today.
Yes, it is, finally. I am that little boy sitting on that window ledge.
Were you a tall? You were a tall man. Were you a tall kid?
I was. I grew big. My elder brother was a scrappy little thing, and I was almost instantly bigger than him as soon as I was born. And I was very tall, much more solid than everybody else. And so I was recruited early, actually, as my brother's bodyguard. And from that point on, I was by the time I was 14, probably everybody else had caught up with me, but I had 10 glorious years as being Superman, effectively.
Did you start fights?
I never started a fight. That was my own particular code of honor. I never started a fight, but I never lost one either.
How about bullies? How did you deal with bullies?
I had a thing going where if they gave me their cookies that they brought for break time, for playtime, I signed people up basically on the basis they would pay me in their biscuits. And they were on my payroll, I would look after them. And if they were having a problem, I would sort it out. I was Reacher for a while.
That must have been great.
Well, it was, yeah. There was, you know, I remember one little girl called Jill who was getting, I guess these days, you know, we would call it inappropriate touching from this other kid called Richard Spears. And she told me about it. So I followed Richard Spears home that afternoon and you know, I'd sorted him out. And it didn't happen again.
Thank you, Mr. Childer. Just doing my job, ma'am.
Exactly. I was living the dream even at that age.
Writer Lee Childer is my guest today, the creator of the Jack Reacher character, the lone hero figure who arrives in town, saves the day, and leaves again. This has sort of continued on somewhat later in life, even though there hasn't been any. Tell me what happened when someone tried to mug you in San Francisco as an adult.
Yeah, that was my first ever book tour for my second book. And I was very enthusiastic about it because they would, you know, send you these cities where you hadn't been before. And it's very exciting. And I would, after the evening event, which would finish, I don't know, 10 o'clock or something like that, I would eat and then I would go for a walk in whatever city I was in because you didn't get much chance for sightseeing, and so I would go out and walk around. And so I was in San Francisco, and the hotel was right next to what they call the Tenderloin, which is kind of the
rough end of town, yeah.
Yeah, the wrong side of town. And so I went out for a walk through that area, and coming back to the hotel, some guy stepped out of the shadows and said, "Give me your money." And, you know, that's a pretty bad thing to hear. And if I'd thought about it, probably I might have given him my money. But the point is, I didn't think about it. I just was instantly, this was probably 30-some years later, but I was just instantly that kid again. I was that kid from Birmingham again, with that instant reaction that I'd learned during those 10 rough years. And so I just slammed him against the wall with my forearm in his throat, and I said, "No, you give me your money." And he did. He gave me his money and I gave it.
The mugger gave you his money?
Yeah, the mugger paid up and I gave it.
How much money?
It wasn't much, maybe $35. And I gave it to the next homeless person I saw on the way back to the hotel.
Robin Hood. Well, not quite, but something like
maybe
that.
Maybe Little John. Yeah, the hooligan one.
That's fantastic. You said in the playground you used to look after your older brother, who was smaller than you. There's parallels there for Jack Reacher too.
Yeah, as writers, we always write kind of what we know. We make it a little bit autobiographical because, I mean, actually writing what you know is bad advice because for a thriller, nobody really knows enough stuff for a really exciting thriller. But it's important to write what you feel. And that was a feeling I had. I mean, it was an institutionalized thing. My parents used to make it clear to me that was my duty. The first moment of playtime, I had to go and check on my brother and make sure he was okay, haul off whoever was beating up on him, deal with it all, and then I could go and play with my own friends.
And what's your brother ended up doing?
He's ended up being a nuclear scientist. So, you know, exactly what you would expect. The pocket protector, the glasses, everything.
And you were his bodyguard.
Yeah, I was from the age of three.
So he's gone on to become the nuclear scientist and you become the best-selling author.
Yeah.
Now, you went and studied law for a while, but your philosophy is study law, but don't be a lawyer. Why?
Because it's a great education. It's a problem if you want to be a lawyer because then other things get in the way. Like you have to worry about actually learning stuff and being top of the class and getting a good job afterward. But if you want a great general education, law is a great subject because that's what law is. Law is a snapshot of everything else. It's a snapshot of the economics, the politics, the sociology, the language of the time. A law made in 1930 is all about the conditions in 1930. And it was a tremendous synthesis of everything I was interested in. And it's a luxury to do it not wanting to be a lawyer because you can graze, you know, do the stuff that you find interesting, skim over the stuff that's boring. Don't worry about exactly what mark you get or grade because it's not going to be relevant.
You spent a bit of time in the theater as well. Why didn't you stay there?
It was one of those intense things, you know, back in the 70s, there was a great theater director called Peter Brook, who was extremely seminal and changed the whole theater world. And he wrote a book called The Empty Space, where he pointed out that all the theater needs, really, is a script and some actors and a space in which to perform it. And I wasn't at that point a writer. I wasn't an actor. I was a backstage type of person. And ultimately, I was convinced that by that intellectual argument that the theater does not absolutely need backstage people. They're not absolutely essential. And so I felt from that point onwards, I felt a bit inadequate. So I went to television where television can't happen without the technicians and the backstage people. I felt I was a lot more essential there.
Yes, I remember reading Nigel Planer's fake memoir of Iron Actor, which is the fake memoir of an actor called Nicholas Craig, who's irritated by the BBC. He says, I don't want to see all these people working around. Who is Viv the Vision Switcher? Need these people. What they need is actors. He said, acting. Tell me what your job was there as presentation director. Do they still exist?
I doubt if they do, because the presentation director was required because it was a network. And certainly what's happened in Britain now is the network has been kind of all consumed by one company. So it's essentially a monolithic organization. It was a bit like an air traffic controller. You sat in a control room with stuff incoming from the network, outgoing from your own station, commercials, trailers, promotions, and you had to put it together into a seamless broadcast. And that was hard enough under normal circumstances, but if there were emergencies to do with the news or anything like that, then you had to cope with that as well. So it was called the central control room where we worked, and it was absolutely central. It was central to the whole operation. So without being directly involved in making any of the programs, we were always involved with administering them, and we would see every kind of program. It wasn't that we specialized in anything. We sat there all day long dealing with everything that was on the schedule. And so it was an incredibly broad experience. In my time there, I was responsible for 40,000 hours of live television. And that was a tremendous education, even though I didn't know that it was at the time.
That would be hectic enough during normal times. What was it like when the Falklands War broke out?
Well, that was actually our golden era. And, you know, sadly, for that job, the worse things got, the more fun it was for us. You know, big disasters or anything like that where we were flying by the seat of our pants was always better. And the Falklands War lasted 3 solid months of flying by the seat of your pants. And it was the only time that I've ever felt, the only time I ever woke up in the night in a sweat. I'd been working all day, went home, went to sleep, and I woke up hearing every telephone ring. We had about 14 telephones in the room, and they were all ringing all day, every day for 3 months. It was awful for the people involved, obviously, in the conflict, but it was great for people in live television.
Outside of crisis periods like that, you must have an encyclopedic knowledge of Coronation Street. You must, because that's Granada, isn't it? And you would have seen episode after episode after episode.
Yeah, and because it was so regular, those people were just worker bees at the station the same as we were. And actually, we became very friendly with most of the cast and the crew for that particular era. I mean, it's long gone, that era now. But I can remember going to the 18th birthday party for Coronation Street when they thought that was, you know, a staggering age for a TV soap. And now what is it? It's 49 years old, that soap.
A lot of people say, you know, I wanted to be a writer since the day I was born, et cetera, et cetera. Were there any lurking thoughts in the back of your mind saying, I want to give all this away and I want to become a best-selling author, Lee?
No, none at all, actually. And I still don't want to be a writer, per se. What I wanted to be was a performer or an entertainer. I always wanted to do that. And I loved the idea of an audience out there being entertained by something I was doing. The problem was, early on, of course, I had no talent, no onstage talent whatsoever. I can't act, I can't sing, I can't dance, I can't tell jokes. I've got no onstage talent, which is why I migrated backstage. And that's kind of how I see books. They're entertainment, and I'm a backstage person because it's actually the book that is out there. It's not the writer, it's the book that's out there. People say politics is show business for ugly people. Well, writing is show business for shy people. You're behind the scenes, and it's your product that is actually in the store.
Nonetheless, even though you didn't really have any specific thoughts of being a writer in your head while you were a presentation director, was there something from that work that you absorbed that was of help to you as a writer?
All kinds of things, yeah. I mean, the familiarity with deadlines, for instance. You know, live television, there are no deadlines. Everything has to be done right then and there. And so the idea of a deadline of a book a year was completely unintimidating to me. The idea of getting it done, you know, we had a motto, do it once, do it right, because that's the only way to get through the day. And that stuck with me. The idea that this is all about the audience. It's nothing else. It's about the audience. It's not about impressing myself or my friends or my family. It's about the audience. That's something that you pick up pretty quickly in television. So, yeah, a lot of things. Nothing specific. Nothing. It's not, you can't use the visual arts as training for the written word because that doesn't work. Then if you try and write a novel as if it were a screenplay or a treatment, then you end up with a really bad screenplay and a really bad novel. You've got to choose. So there's no direct carryover.
But what, I mean, just what you have to say, though, about deadlines, really what you're talking about there is being able to make decisions, lots of decisions, and make them quickly and move through them. I have friends who are writers, and when they're unhappy is when they really can't make up their minds about things and they get distracted onto the internet or whatever so they don't have to make a decision. But you don't have that problem then. You can make decisions, bang, bang, bang.
Yeah, it's about making the choice, the decision of what you're going to do on that particular page or in that particular chapter. Just make the decision and move on. And then it's also about letting it go. You know, if you know this, you know, we're doing a live show here, and when it's done, it's done. There's nothing you can do about it. It's over.
It's out there in the world, and you can't bring it back again.
Exactly. No. And that is something that writers often don't get. You know, they finish the first draft, and they revise it endlessly revising because they're afraid to let it go. But television teaches you to let it go. It's done. It's out there. I mean, people say to me, are the things that you would like to change in your earlier books? And if I thought about it, well, yeah, but the point is they're out there. You know, it's too late to change them. And that is very much a broadcasting attitude that I've carried over.
Did you have a sense of things going downhill before you were fired from television?
Yeah, I had a very clear, because I'm always very interested in the business side of anything. And like I said earlier, I love to know how things work. And so I keep an eye on it. And I could tell pretty, I don't know, 5-6 years in advance, I knew it was all going to come crashing down. And
this is even when you're going through this golden period when you know you're producing a lot of, you know, really seminal series on TV at this time.
Yeah, I mean, because of the golden period, in a sense, because these were fabulous shows. You know, we did a long series of fabulous shows: Brideshead Revisited, Jewel in the Crown, Prime Suspect, Cracker, just one thing after another. But they were expensive, and we were expensive. We were well paid, well compensated. Everything was a high budget operation, and I could just tell this was the 90s by then, and it was wrong. You know, high-budget operations were not going to survive, even though we were profitable, I mean immensely profitable. The spirit of the 90s was to say immense profits are not enough. You know, we have to have obscene profits. And the quick way of getting obscene profits is, of course, to cut costs. And I knew that would come along. I could see it coming 5 or 6 years in advance. Everybody else was happy. But I was thinking, this is going to come to an end. And so over that 5 to 6 years, I did vaguely start to think, what should I do? What am I going to do next? And it was funny, having read all my life, I'd read thousands, tens of thousands of books all my life, never really thought about how they got there. In that 5 or 6 year period, I started to see what the writers were doing and how they were doing it and why they were doing it. It was a kind of gradual education.
How did it all come to an end in television? And what forced you to make that decision?
Well, it was they were going to fire everybody, shake it all up. And the way to do that was obviously to break the union first. And so they put it about that when the present shop steward's term ended, anybody that stood for the vacancy would be instantly fired and never work again in the industry. It was a threat, basically, to expedite their plans.
I didn't think that would be legal, but there you are.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't think anything was ever written down, but I know it's true because I felt that this was unjust. This was my real-life Jack Reacher moment. I felt it was unjust and wrong. So I stood for Shop Steward, and one of the managers took me aside and said, don't do it. You'll be gone in a week, and you will never work in the industry again. And I thought, well, let's see. And so I got elected unopposed, and that 1 week turned into 117 weeks, 2 years and 3 months. I was shop steward, fighting this rearguard action, trying to preserve what I could, trying to get people outplaced better with better severance and better pensions and so on. But eventually they pulled this coup on me. I took a week's holiday, went to Spain. I got back, and there was a message on my answering machine saying, don't come back to work. That's it. You're fired. And that was the end of it.
Did you have a family to look after at that point?
Yeah. I had a wife and a daughter aged 15. We had a mortgage and, you know, credit cards and a car loan and all that kind of stuff. So it was very serious.
How old were you at that stage, Lee?
I was 39, just about to turn 40.
Were you devastated?
I was not devastated personally. I mean, I was extremely upset on behalf of other people and the institution that had just been trashed. You know, Granada Television was a fine institution that had been built up by two generations of people working very hard, and it had been torn down and vandalized. I was upset about that, but for myself, I thought, no, I'll find something else to do. I'll be all right.
Yeah, it's a double. You're just about to hit 40, and something you'd worked for that you believed in, a really good thing, was pulled apart for no good reason by idiots.
Yeah.
That can make you very bitter.
Yeah, it did make me bitter. And the funny thing about it is that I imagined I would find another thing to do, and over a period of time I would get into the new thing and forget the old thing. And I certainly have got into the new thing. And as you were kind enough to point out, you know, these are best-selling books all over the world.
You've done all right.
Done all right. But I am still just as bitter as I was the day I left about what happened in television.
Do you make more money now than your former bosses at Granada?
I think I make more money than any 20 of them, yeah.
So how did you start writing then? You had this idea that maybe you could do this. You'd been studying some of the thrillers you'd been reading. Tell me about starting down and how you wrote the first novel, Killing Floor.
Well, by that point, I'd had more than 20 years altogether in terms of theatre, television, and so on, and I knew enough to know that you can't think too much about it. If you start to think about it, then you end up paralyzed because you start to think, okay, well, look, there's these women aged 34 to 49, but, you know, I need the guys aged 18 to 24, and I need this and I need that. And if you start thinking like that, then you end up with a laundry list and the whole thing just comes out cardboard.
And that's why so much television is bad these days too. It's exactly that kind of thinking, I think.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Mm. And so I knew enough to know that I couldn't do that. So even though I knew a lot actually about what audiences wanted, I thought what I have to do is just close my mind to that completely and just write from the gut. Just let it come out. Just write exactly what I want to write, because that is the only way to get a book that has a kind of spark to it, that's vivid, that's organic, and that's alive. So I did that. And that first book, Killing Floor, I thought it came out really well, but I thought, you know, these guys are going to like this maybe, because they'll like tough guy fiction, but I think women, I've blown it with women because, you know, this guy is a filthy, dirty, rough, tough barbarian. Women are going to stay away. And I was completely wrong about that. And that just shows you what you can do if you actually don't think about it too much. Just write from the gut, hope for the best, and see what happens.
You know, we can look back in hindsight and see this as a kind of a fairy tale that's come true for you. You know, the guy is doing a good job. He's defeated by, you know, mediocre people, and he takes up a new career, becomes a big success. But it wasn't apparent for you at that time, when you're halfway through that narrative, if you like.
Mm-hmm.
What was the response from people like your wife and from your friends when you say, I am giving up television, I shall become a writer?
It was, you know, everybody, all my friends were in the same boat, you know, and it was a dire period. And so anything anybody said, it was just a question, well, good luck, mate, you know. My wife was extremely supportive. I mean, worried as you could be. But she said, look, all right, take a year, try it, and then we'll reassess a year from now. If it falls apart, then maybe you'll have to get another job somewhere else. So she was biting her nails but biting her lip at the same time, and while I just got on with it.
You see, that's the other side of the thing, is it means you're going to be around the house all the time.
Yeah,
previously you've been out all day, and
I'd been out all day and all night, you know, because the hours were horrendous, and so that was a major change. You're quite right, and actually, that's a difficult thing to deal with, and I think people in general find that difficult to deal with.
How hard was it to shop that first novel around?
It was not hard at all. I finished it. I sent it to an agent, and the agent took it on. And from that point on, then it's his business to sell it and get the deal. And he did, actually, pretty quickly.
Was it a wild ride? It's not like being a rock star, is it? But it's not a million miles different from that when you have suddenly a best-selling novel and it's your very first one.
Well, the truth is, it sold well. The first, you know, it was a good, solid, substantial start. But the thing about the book business is, unless, you know, it's some freak occurrence, for virtually all of us, it's a long slog. That old cliche, it takes you 10 years to become an overnight success, that's absolutely true. Each book got slightly better and slightly better sales and slightly better recognition, but the quasi-rock star thing, that does not kick in until 10 years down the track. And you just got to keep showing up every year, just keep doing a book every year, and eventually it will happen. And it did, but it was 10 long years until it really became automatic.
I think it can be said that your style, you write in quite American English in a funny sort of way. I mean, your books are Jack Reacher's an American, they're set in the United States. You write in these kind of terse, tight sentences that are descriptive, but they're not florid. It's this tense language that has a lot of hard consonants in it. Is that intentional?
Yeah, it is. It's about creating the pace and the drive, and it's about using what the reader already knows. If in three or four words you can kick off an impression in the reader's head that they already possess from something else, in other words, it's like auto-suggestion. You don't have to describe the whole thing. You just have to spark the reader to describe it for themselves. You know, sketch it in and let the reader fill in the blanks. Plus, I was also very aware of how things are consumed. And books are generally consumed under pretty fraught conditions these days. You know, very few people get 3 or 4 hours to sit down and read. What they do is they read for 20 minutes on the train to work, and they maybe grab another 20 minutes over lunch, and then they read another 20 minutes coming back home, and then 15 minutes before they fall asleep. And so you've got to take that into account. You cannot have a situation of just these long, rambling sentences where that night maybe the reader is picking it up. She hasn't looked at it for 24 hours. She picks it up, and she thinks, now, who was that guy? You've got to keep it clear and concise and linear so that you are actually helping the reader through what I know is a stressful day for them. You know, they're not sitting around sipping tea, reading books while somebody fans them. These are working people who are reading in little fragmented bites, and we've got to accommodate that.
Yeah, the first horror novels were, you know, Mary Shelley's Frankenstein and other novels which have a gothic feel to them, which are claustrophobic and close and very European. And you've got Stephen King, who writes a really different kind of, and a very American sort of horror, where there's a sense of openness there. Do you see that same kind of difference between thriller writers in the UK and thriller writers who set their books in the United States?
Yeah, absolutely, because environment creates a lot of background, obviously, for a story. And the environment in Britain, for instance, is very tight, very densely populated. Everybody's cheek by jowl. There is no space. there are no physical secrets in that sense. And so English thrillers tend to be very internal and psychological. The stress is inside people's heads, basically. Whereas setting them in America gives you this gigantic landscape, you know, the huge geography, where you can have physical secrets. You can have isolated towns. You can have mysterious things appearing on the prairie. There's nothing else within 50 miles. You can have wanderers, people that come into a place unknown. So it gives you a much more external type of story rather than internal.
Writing your first book, as you did, Killing Floor, you wrote it longhand.
Yeah, because
on the dining table.
Yeah, on those pads of paper with that pencil that I bought, because I'm a terrible hobbyist. You know, if there's something I like, you know, photography or whatever it might be, I rush out and I buy the gear. And I wanted to emphasize to myself, this was not a hobby. This is for real. This is a job. And so I couldn't buy the stuff until I'd earned the stuff. And therefore, the first book I wrote in pencil, and I typed it up on my daughter's computer. I didn't have one. Borrowed my daughter's, typed it up, and then when that book sold, then I bought my own computer because it was for real. It was a job. It wasn't for fun.
When did you know, writing, that this was more than a job and this is something you actually loved doing?
I knew actually pretty early in that first book because, as you just pointed out, I was at home all the time. And the problem when you're at home all the time is you're suddenly available.
For chores.
Yeah, for errands. And I was sitting there, I remember it well, Friday night I was sitting there and mulling over in my head what I was going to write the next morning and really, really looking forward to it. And then my wife reminded me I'd signed up for a chore. I had to be somewhere else tomorrow morning. And I can remember being bitterly, bitterly disappointed that I wouldn't be able to write that scene tomorrow morning. And at that point, I thought, this is going to work, because if I feel like that writing it, then people are going to feel like that reading it.
I think Clive James, I saw an interview with Clive James with Andrew Denton. I think he said that pretty much the same thing. He has to have an office that's separate from the home so he can sit around and do nothing and just think. Otherwise, if he's seen around the house doing that, he'll be asked to go and lift something heavy.
Exactly, yeah. I've done the same thing. I have a physically separate office. It's actually a different apartment from the one that we live in.
Writing a thriller, Lee, is character or plot more important?
Character, without a doubt. I mean, plot is great. And obviously I try very hard, and we all do, to have a great story and a great plot. But ultimately, plot is not that important. Nobody really remembers the plot. People remember the character. People are much more interesting. People are the Lone Ranger. Everybody remembers the Lone Ranger. Not one person on earth could tell you a storyline from a Lone Ranger episode.
And research, reading the start of your book, it's clear you really know what a luxury greyhound bus is, what it does, how it works, where the fire extinguisher is in it, where the water container is at the back of the bus. I mean, it's all crucial to the detail and that moment-by-moment description you have of a bus going haywire on a frozen road. Are you going out there and finding a bus and sort of going over it with a fine-tooth comb, Lee?
No, I mean, this will be an assemblage of something I've seen in a movie or seen on television or I've read in a magazine. Like I said, I love trivial stuff, and the exact location of the water tank in a luxury bus is of burning interest to me. I love to know stuff like that. And so maybe years ago I will have read some technical article in some bus magazine just out of interest, just because I'm fascinated by that stuff. And then I file it away mentally, and then years later it pops up and becomes useful.
Wonderful to meet you, Lee, and thank you so much for being my guest this hour in conversation.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.